no idea. And the relationship with Iran seems to be the only one that's positive compared to the other countries around Armenia.
Now, Iran is a country that is very controversial.
Controversial would be an understatement.
And could you flesh that out a bit?
Well, basically, the reason I see it is because Iran has a pipeline going through Armenia, up north and into the sea above. So that's their gateway to Europe to get their gas out. And if Azerbaijan decides to take over that part of Armenia and cut that tie off, now Azerbaijan has his gas and they see conflict. So Iran, I think, is only thinking about their pipeline and protecting it.
What other countries are involved?
Well, the major player here is Russia. Russia's always been sort of like the abusive big brother of Armenia since Armenia became independent. And right now, they're practically the peacekeepers in the Artsakh region, protecting the people, so-called protecting the people there.
And Turkey?
Well, Turkey's been the partner of Azerbaijan, and they've come out, or Erdogan has come out and said, we are one people, two states. So basically, they see themselves as the same.
Are they the same?
Not really. They're actually once majority Sunnite, once majority Shiite. But for some reason, they seem to feel like they're like brothers. Erdogan and Aliyev, the president of Azerbaijan, are seen together quite often. And Aliyev sees Erdogan as a leader of the world.
On that note, Peter Balwanian, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you again, John.
This is John Crumshaw for KPFK, Politics or Pedagogy. For the Pacifica Radio Archives collection of Martin Luther King's speeches or a larger collection of Voices That Changed the World, call 818-985-5735 and press 2 to make your pledge. Like what you hear on KPFK? Call 818-985-5735 and press 2 to become a sustaining member.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson. You're listening to Radical Free Speech Radio, KPFK, in Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. In 1790, Congress enacted naturalization laws in which citizenship in the U.S. was limited to white persons until 1952, when the racial restriction was formally lifted. A number of immigration cases were brought to court in which people had to claim a white racial identity in order to naturalize. From its inception, U.S. immigration laws have been designed to reinforce white supremacy and systemic racism, which includes anti-Muslim racism. Take, for example, the 1942 case In re Ahmed Hassan, which involved a man from Yemen applying for citizenship in the United States. He was told by the judge that because of his identity as a Muslim, he is not white, and is therefore ineligible for citizenship. We continue to see until today immigration laws and enforcement that, although seemingly neutral on their face, are still motivated by the same racial animus of excluding, punishing, and criminalizing immigrants of color, and are still deeply rooted in anti-Muslim racism. In her most recent op-ed entitled Afghan Asylum Seekers Are Being Denied Their Religious Rights in ICE Prisons, Leila Ayoub discusses exactly this, stating, quote, "Detained Afghan asylum seekers remind us that the U.S. immigration system is rooted in anti-Muslim racism," end quote. With us today to talk about the discrimination, criminalization, and violence detained Afghan asylum seekers are experiencing in U.S. immigration detentions, and how the treatment of Afghan asylum seekers reminds us that the U.S. immigration system is rooted in anti-Muslim racism, is our guest, Leila Ayoub, an Afghan-American lawyer and co-founder and director of Project ANAR, ANAR standing for Afghan Network for Advocacy and Resources. Project Anar is a grassroots, young, women-led Afghan community-based immigration organization in the U.S. Project Anar has spearheaded immigration legal services, education, and advocacy for Afghans nationally and in the San Francisco Bay Area and Washington, D.C. areas. Layla Ayoub helped launch Project Anar in August of 2021, and through her leadership, the organization has created legal resources to democratize access to immigration legal services for Afghans and made waves exposing disparities in U.S. government immigration responses. Welcome, Layla Ayoub, to Middle East in Focus. We are so honored to have you on our show and to highlight the amazing work you and your organization are doing.
Hi, Nagwa. Thank you so much for having me on.
Can you first tell us a little bit more about your organization, Project Anar?
Sure. So Project Anar came together in August 2021. We were a group of Afghan Americans who found ourselves assisting our own family and friends, our community with their immigration legal services needs. We brought together ad hoc resources to do what we could to eliminate the barriers that folks in our community were facing trying to reach the U.S. to seek refuge, to seek family reunification. So we brought volunteer lawyers together. We trained them. We raised money to address these immediate needs. And we quickly found that the government, the U.S. government, was not willing to accept many of the applications that we were filing, that our community was filing at that time. So we had to quickly come together to do advocacy. And since then, we've continued to work to address the shifting needs and fill in the gaps that our community is facing in trying to access immigration relief.
So I definitely, and we'll get into it later in the show about why the U.S. government wasn't accepting these applications. But before we get into all of that, as well as what was happening to Afghan asylum seekers while in detention, can you first talk about why Afghan asylum seekers were being detained to begin with in immigration detention facilities, and how even such decisions to detain them were rooted in anti-Muslim racism?
Right. So this has been a recent thing that because the barriers that Afghans have faced in trying to reach the U.S., they've brought themselves to the U.S.-Mexico border like so many other communities. And at the border, the treatment they receive is so discretionary. It can be up to the whims of an individual agent, but it's also part of this implementation of anti-asylum policies that happen at the border. So we see that that disproportionately affects many communities, including Muslims, because their faith is criminalized. So one example of that is in Texas, we've been seeing this policy where asylum seekers are facing criminal repercussions. They're put in criminal custody, not just immigration custody. That was disproportionately affecting Muslim men, including Afghans. And we also see that in the immigration system, families, even when we aren't seeing that zero tolerance policy under the previous administration, family separation still happens at the border. And if someone's an adult legally, they're often separated from their family and they're placed in immigration detention. So that, again, it disproportionately affects men and Muslims in general. And then there's also just this these barriers that people face because they haven't been able to speak to a lawyer before they are screened by immigration officials. They don't have access in their languages, and they haven't been able to prepare and understand the things that immigration officials are considering when they're screening someone at the border. And that results in their identities being used to criminalize them, to flag them, usually arbitrarily, as a national security risk, which can be so hard to challenge and to overcome when you're in this very discretionary system. And that just makes people end up detained. And then once they're there in these faraway, purposely far away from many communities in the U.S. They have little access to legal services as well. So the people that we get in touch with, it's very organic. They reach us through their family members who are not detained most of the time, or maybe they connect with another organization that knows that our organization is Afghan immigration lawyers. We can speak their languages. So we don't even know how many other people might be in similar situations to our clients.
So, you know, one of the things, I have to say it, I loved your op-ed so much. Really important piece. And one of the things I really appreciate is that you use the language anti-Muslim racism rather than mm-hmm. just Islamophobia, which I think is a really important distinction. You were talking just now about how, you know, those who were because of the many barriers that Afghans were experiencing in applying for status here in the U.S. And the only reason that's the case is because of over 20 years of U.S. war and occupation of Afghanistan, that they're even having to flee their homes, that because of all of these barriers in applying for relief, that's why some were just choosing to come to the border and request asylum that way. And you talked about how there can be discretion utilized in who gets detained and who doesn't. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit more in how was that discretion being used specifically with Afghans? What was the argument being used to say they have to be detained?
Right. I can even take a step back to those barriers they were facing. So we see really blatant examples of racism. And like you said, we use that term anti-Muslim racism because it is a systemic thing. It's not just Islamophobia. It's not just feelings. It's something that is implemented through policies and through laws. So we spent months trying to push for pathways for our community. And the very things that we asked for, we were told were not possible for various reasons. And we obviously knew that that's not true because the U.S. government has resources. If they don't, then who else does? And they were quickly able to implement many of the things that we were asking for when Ukrainians were fleeing their country. Literally the exact same program that we were asking for, a parole program for our community, was implemented for Ukrainians. And of course, we think they should have gotten that, but it's an example that could be used for other communities, and we just haven't seen that happen in an equitable way. And so that's why our community is at the border. And when they're there, we can't say that there's a policy that says all the Afghans need to be detained, but we just see it happen often. This is the reality for so many other nationalities as well. They end up in detention centers. So it's not every single Afghan that's crossing the border, but the ways to avoid that, for example, include this policy right now. It's the CBP1 app. It's been called the Ticketmaster of the border policies of asylum seeking because it's so inaccessible. It has so many issues and it's not available in the languages that Afghans speak. So those are the ways that we see that this racism is built into the system. And even if there's not a flat out policy that says all the Afghans need to be detained, all the asylum seekers from Haiti, from African countries need to be detained, we see that it plays out that way because of these very deliberate and barriers that don't have to be that way.
Yeah. And I, you know, exactly to your point is that that is how racism works. It's that you have these sort of what seem to be neutral laws or neutral systems, right. Neutral policies. There's no mention of race, but they are disproportionately targeting for detention, for exclusion from immigration status in the United States. They are disproportionately targeting immigrants of color, right. And specifically specifically to the points that you're making, specifically disproportionately targeting Afghans and actually Muslim immigrants from various places in the world as a whole. You talked about the parole program that was implemented for Ukrainians that you were asking for Afghans. For those that don't know, can you explain what it is when you say a parole program, what that looked like for Ukrainians that wasn't provided for Afghans? And then also within that conversation, can you talk about the application fees also presenting as a barrier for Afghans in accessing what should be their right to get refuge away from the violence that was caused by the United States in their home country?
Right. So when the refugee program is inaccessible, you know, we call Afghans refugees, we call many different communities refugees, but that actually has a legal definition. And the refugee program is pretty inaccessible. You have to have access to a third country, which Afghans have virtually no access to third countries where they can actually stay in order to complete the refugee process. So you need permission to reach the U.S. in order to seek asylum. That's the alternative if you can't become a refugee and get that designation and then reach the U.S. as a refugee. So parole is one of those ways that someone can get permission to come to the U.S. so they can apply for asylum here. So in theory, you know, if the U.S. doesn't want people to cross the border, then they should make that accessible so that people have that permission. And we just didn't see that happen. So we helped many people apply, and many people in our community, in other communities, they try to access parole applications, which they can do. And those are individual applications. So each person in a family, including a child, needs to file their own. And for the normal process, it has a $575 per person application fee. So one of the things that we asked for example, was a family-based application, because of course people are applying as families and they want to be able to come here together and to waive those application fees. And we assume that, you know, everything we're asking for isn't going to happen. So at least we can raise money to help people file those applications, assuming the government might accept some of them. And that was one of the things that we did. And still, the majority of those decided were not accepted. But we saw that for Ukrainians, they created a program where it was family-based applications. They eliminated the application fee. And they've done versions of that for some other communities. But even those are less accessible. For example, they include caps that the Ukrainian program did not have. So there's things like that where we see that it's just not as accessible, and it's not the same thing.
And one of the things that I'm not shocked by, but I had never seen the actual figure, was the fact that and correct me if I'm wrong, but that the U.S. government made $20 million off the application fees from Afghans.
Yeah. So, and this is another example of how we're faced with barriers, right? So access to information is another way that we are prevented from properly advocating for our community, and that our community members who are dealing with these challenges can't properly advocate for themselves. And so we got that information through various FOIA requests to force the government to hand over that information, because we knew that it must have been a lot of money that they made off of our community. And so the numbers that we got, which at this point are a couple years old, were over $20 million, which it's just shocking. And it really shows that this immigration system, the applications people are filing, it's going towards the government. They're making money off of our people. And, you know, people would try that. People would deal with those fees if it actually led to something. And unfortunately, for the majority of people, it hasn't.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking today about the discrimination, criminalization, and violence detained Afghan asylum seekers are experiencing in U.S. immigration detentions, and how the treatment of Afghan asylum seekers reminds us that the U.S. immigration system is rooted in anti-Muslim racism, with our guest, Leila Ayoub, an Afghan-American lawyer and co-founder and director of Project ANAR, a grassroots young women-led Afghan community-based immigration organization in the U.S. that has spearheaded immigration legal services, education, and advocacy for Afghans nationally and in the San Francisco Bay Area and Washington, D.C. areas. So, Leila, one of the things that you had talked about is, and that we've been talking about is that, you know, what we see within the immigration system, and that is rooted within the immigration system, is both anti-Muslim racism and structural Islamophobia, and really how important it is to understand both. And that they're not necessarily the same thing. Islamophobia is really this idea of people being denied the right to practice their religion, Islam, whereas anti-Muslim racism is that people are being denied their civil and human rights based on their Muslim identity or perceived Muslim identity. And really what you have is both. Now I want – and we've been talking about sort of how we're seeing anti-Muslim racism play out and how we're seeing that with Afghan asylum seekers. I want to now talk about some of the Islamophobia, too, that's being experienced by Afghan asylum seekers while in immigration detention here in the U.S. Can you talk about the type of systemic discrimination and violence Afghan asylum seekers are experiencing within U.S. immigration detention centers and how they're being denied the right to practice Islam?
Right. So we just came out of the month of Ramadan when many Muslims are fasting, and it just made a lot of the challenges that they face and the discrimination that they face even more obvious. So around, like, all of our clients were reporting consistently that they received their meals at inappropriate times. So they would be given their morning meal to prepare for their fast in the middle of the night, like at 1 a.m. or 2 a.m., which is hours before the day begins. And then they would receive their evening meal to break their fast hours late, which just makes it so much harder for them to have enough energy to make it through the day. It's also preventing them from properly practicing their faith, because it's important to break your fast at a certain time, to eat and start your day at a certain time for Muslims. And some of the other things that we saw were this, like, gendered aspect to it, too. I mean, I already mentioned we see that men are often criminalized, but we see that women are also, like, punished in a certain way in immigration detention. And so when Muslims are praying and fasting, they have to cleanse themselves in a certain way and perform their ablutions, and they take a water bottle into the bathroom to do that in the detention center. And we've had our clients report that they were reprimanded for doing that. They were, their water bottles were getting confiscated. And it's very much reinforcing these power dynamics in the immigration detention center. It's making people afraid fearful for practicing their faith. Some of the other things that we see very consistently are just, like, inappropriate diets, where maybe they're told this is halal meat, it's meat that they can eat that complies with their religious dietary requirements. But oftentimes they might just get a meal with the meat removed. And these are things that we see. There's so much documentation of this happening for years and years. And it's never properly addressed. And part of the reason why is because it's, again, like, our clients report it to us, and people who don't have access to someone in detention, you're just not seeing this. And there's also this fear, because someone is trying to obtain asylum here and stay here, they're afraid of reporting these things. And that's on purpose, too.
And, you know, as you importantly state in your piece, and I'm just going to quote you here, quote, anti-Muslim racism and structural Islamophobia form the foundations of our modern immigration agencies, end quote. Can you elaborate on this and provide some of that historical context?
Right. So I think this is really important to remind ourselves because when we try to push back on these systems and these agencies and talk about defunding them, it seems like a really radical thing. But the reality is that these agencies, as they exist today, the Department of Homeland Security, ICE, they all formed in 2003 in direct response to 9/11. And yes, there was racism and expulsion and anti-immigrant policies baked into the immigration system before that. But just as these new agencies formed in the last few decades, they can as easily be changed into something else and to something that actually welcomes people and gives them dignity. And yeah, so that's really what it is that they were formed directly in response through legislation that was implemented right after 9/11, taking advantage of people's fears and making Islamophobia, anti-Muslim racism, and this idea of keeping people out of the country and that they have to prove that they're not criminals, they're not threats to national security, instead of just letting them come here and be treated with their rights and dignity, it made that the policy approach to immigration.
Yeah, and to the point that you've been making throughout this conversation is that based on people's identity of just being Muslim alone, they are deemed a national security risk. And then that is used to justify criminalization, violence, and exclusion. I'm going to combine the last two questions into one because we only have a few minutes here. You talk about in your op-ed how the policies that DHS implements are rooted in exclusion, punishment, and systemic racism, and that Afghans are not isolated in what they experience at the hands of these agencies, that this is something that affects many immigrant communities of color. So I want you to elaborate on that as well as really elaborate and talk more about something else you really focus on in your piece, which is the importance of connecting movements for justice and how you and your organization are doing just that and why you believe coalition building and recognizing the interconnectedness of social justice issues is not only important but actually essential.
Right. So I was an immigration lawyer before August 2021, and I was definitely drawn to this because of my family's experiences. But what they went through a few decades ago, it was different from what our community is going through now. So for years, I was working with other immigrant communities who are in immigration detention, and they're going through many of these same things. They are facing all these challenges. They face different kinds of discrimination, of criminalization of their identities and of their immigration status. That is the standard that everyone who's coming here seeking asylum is dealing with that on some level. So it's really in these last few years that I have found myself in our organization, we found ourselves working with our own community members who are in this position and increasingly seeing more and more Muslims who are dealing with these issues. You know, we make those connections and we remind our Afghan American community about that as well. We really think it's important to educate everyone so that they can take part in this immigration advocacy. We feel that it's not necessarily our role to be every single person's lawyer, but to help them get access to resources because everyone is resourceful and they can do a lot on their own. And we see that they do the same things themselves. The clients that we work with, the people that we work with in immigration detention, they're telling us stories about how they have made this journey to the border with other people from other nationalities. They don't even share the same languages, but they speak to each other. They advocate for one another, and they take care of one another, and they elevate each other's concerns from detention centers, and share that with us. So we gain a lot of inspiration from them, and we really try to implement that ourselves as well. So in these last 6 months, it's been really important for us to be in solidarity with and active solidarity with other communities, with Palestinians who are seeking immigration justice for their loved ones. And beyond that, recognizing that the violence that they face is directly connected to the violence that we see at the southern border in immigration detention, and in all of the countries.